What is up? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Rika the Renz, also known as Ricky Vrenz, and a great episode for you today. Today's one of those really awesome stories about a guest I've wanted on my show for a long time. Haven't had much luck getting hold of them. Then out of nowhere, they're promoting a book and they want to come on the show. So I'm really excited to have Dr. Robert Lustig to come on to talk about his new book, Metabolical, The Lore and the Lies of Processed Foods, Nutrition, and Modern Medicine. And one thing I love about Dr. Lustig is that he really goes into the history of how we got here and how our diets changed, the bad science that led us to change our diets, some of the big food and big pharma influence on our poor health today. So all these things are super important and you're definitely going to learn a lot. I'll put links to his book in the show description. And speaking of books and supporting people like Dr. Lustig, this is a value for value show. If you can't support the show financially, then there's a couple ways you can do it. We have a Patreon page. We have a PayPal account, and we're on Rockfin. If you want to support us on Rockfin, go there, make a free account, check out all the free content. And if you like it, then sign up, get a premium account, and get all the premium content. It's a Netflix of alternative media and sports, tons of free stuff, so go check it out. And the cool thing is when you sign up for Rockfin, you support every content creator that's on there, so that's awesome. So that will be in the show description also. If you can't financially support the show on Patreon, PayPal, or on Rockfin, or getting merch, of course, RippleEffectPodcastMerch.com. Another way you can support the show, just spreading these conversations. Let people know about them, share them, review, rate, go on iTunes, wherever you listen to podcasts, and just give us thumbs up, subscribe, all that type of stuff, and that goes a long way too. So any way you can help, it's appreciated, and I hope you guys really enjoyed this conversation. We had a fun discussion, and I know I've had a lot of doctors on, a lot of people who talk about nutrition on the show, but I promise you, you are going to learn something new. And if you hold on till the end of the show, you'll hear our little disagreement, which was fun. And I love the fact that I can have guests on who I might disagree with on certain things, and I can highlight the stuff I agree with and also discuss the things I might disagree with. And that's all super important. You have to be able to have those discussions. So enjoy this conversation, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Peace.
Well, going against the grain, I guess that's just, you know, part and parcel of, you know, being a scientist. You know, after all, scientists' job is to overthrow the previous generation's dogma. You know, I've always believed there's only one dogma. There is no dogma. That's the dogma. Whatever we believed 10 years ago is already wrong. Whatever we believe today will be wrong 10 years from now. Point is, somebody's got to basically do that overturning. And that's the job of the scientist. So I've always felt that way. You know, it's just that I ended up in a political hornet's nest because what the work I did was make a lot of industries very uncomfortable. So, you know, it's not a whole lot different from what I did when I studied sex differentiation of the brain. It's just that, you know, now there's more, more money riding on it. That's all. So my origin story, I'll sum it up in one sentence. I went from brain tumors to obesity to insulin to metabolic syndrome to sugar to addiction to public health to policy to law. That's basically my origin story. You know, I started out just being a pediatric endocrinologist. I had a specific interest in neuroendocrinology, you know, how the brain controls hormones, how hormones control the brain. I was interested in obesity, but didn't really understand it or know much about it until the year 1994. And in 1994, something major happened. We discovered a hormone called leptin. Leptin is this hormone that goes from your fat cells to your brain and tells your brain basically how much energy is on board. It's kind of a servo mechanism. when your leptin levels are low, your brain thinks there's no fat. It thinks you're starving. And so you eat, and you also cut down on your burning in an attempt to try to build more fat to raise your leptin levels. So it's the same as the thermostat in your house. Clearly, something was wrong with the obese, because something must be wrong with their leptin. Because if their leptin was working right, they wouldn't be obese. At the same time this happened in 1994, 1 year later, I started working at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. You know, the pediatric cancer hospital. And so we had a whole stable, a whole cadre of pediatric patients who had survived their brain tumors, only to become massively obese after the tumor therapy, either the surgery or the radiation. Whatever it was, all of a sudden, these kids, they had been normal weight their entire lives until the tumor, and now they're 400 pounds. And the parents would come to me and say, you know, this is double jeopardy. You know, my kids survive the tumor only to succumb to the treatment. And it was up to me, it was my charge to basically take care of these kids and figure out what was going on and what we could do about it. So I did my due diligence. I went to the literature, and as being a neuroendocrinologist, I was, shall we say, prepared. You know, chance favors the prepared mind. And, you know, there's an entire literature of hypothalamic lesions, the area of the brain that controls hormones, the hypothalamus. I'm a hypothalamus doctor. And you, if you destroy this area, basically the rat becomes massively obese. And the question is why? Well, it turns out these rats make an enormous amount of the hormone insulin. So leptin had just been discovered. We pieced together a possible mechanism where the leptin, which was signaling the brain properly before, now, because of the tumor, wasn't. And because the brain couldn't see the leptin, these people thought they were starving. Their brains thought they were starving. And because of that, they ate more and exercised less and burned energy less just at rest. And so they became massively obese. So if that's true, and we knew that these kids had very high insulin levels. So I asked the question, well, I can't fix the leptin problem. Maybe I can work downstream and fix the insulin problem. So we gave these kids a medicine, a drug that suppresses insulin release at the level of the pancreas, a drug called octreotide. This was now 26 years ago. And the very first patient, you know, patient number one, I didn't know what to expect. I'd never used octreotide before. Patient number one, I told the mom, you know, once we put the kid on the drug, you know, we did it in a protocolized fashion, you know, with IRB approval and all that. I told her, you know, give me a call in 2 weeks and tell me how things are going. Well, she gives me a call in 1 week, frantic, at the top of her lungs on the phone, Dr. Lustig, something's happening. And I go, oh God, you know, adverse event, you know, shut down the study, go to jail. I was just, you know, waiting for the other shoe to drop. Well, what happened? And the mom says, well, normally we would go to Taco Bell and she would eat 5 tacos and an enchilito and she'd still be hungry. Well, we just went to Taco Bell and she ate 2 tacos and she was full and she just vacuumed the house. So these were kids who sat on the couch, ate Doritos, and slept. And all of a sudden, this kid was active. And it turned out all the other kids got active. One kid became a competitive swimmer. 2 kids started lifting weights at home. 1 kid became the manager of his high school baseball team, running around collecting all the baseballs. You know, these were kids who did nothing. They were lumps on a log. You know, the parents decried, you know, the fact that they had lost their kid, even though their kid was alive. And all of a sudden they get say, I got my kid back. And the kid says things like, this is the first time my head hasn't been in the clouds since the tumor. This is very powerful. Well, basically for the last 26 years, I've been basically following the science of this pathway ever since. And what we've realized is, yes, not everybody has a brain tumor. So there are a lot of people who are obese without being, you know, from a brain tumor. And it turns out they're obese because their insulin's high anyway. And then the question is, how come their insulin's high if they don't have a brain tumor? And the answer is one word: sugar. And that's how I got into this.
Yeah, that's the thing that I try to tell people. It's for a long time we were told these lies. I mean, when I was growing up, it was this food pyramid that on the bottom of the pyramid was all grains and all this stuff. And now it's like, you know, and we were even sold this idea that multigrains are good for you. You know, you see multigrain on something, it's like, oh, dark rice must be better than white rice, or multigrain this must be better than that. And if you look at the history of like the way we ate to the way we eat, like what happened? What was that transition to demonizing fats, demonizing all these things, you know, red meat, demonizing all these things, and then taking all the attention off sugar? Like sugar was this thing where they wanted us to believe it was an empty calorie, it had no effect, and just ignore it. Just look at the other things. Just ignore sugar. What caused all that?
Well, a grand subterfuge, a propaganda campaign caused that. So the question is, how did this all come about? Well, it really started in 1955. And in 1955, President Eisenhower had a heart attack. And all of a sudden, everybody's radar just, you know, went on ballistic. You know, what is causing all the heart disease in the country? Eisenhower's cardiologist, Paul Dudley White, who was the head of cardiology at Mass General, had published a book back in 1931 called Heart Disease, and didn't get a whole lot of play at the time. But all of a sudden, heart disease was just, you know, smack dab in front of everybody. What causes heart disease? Because we got to do something about it, because our president almost died of it. And so shortly thereafter, two factions sprang up. One was led by a Minnesota epidemiologist who was famous at the time, and his name was Dr. Ansel Keys. And Ansel Keys was the inventor back in World War II of the K ration, the Keys ration. This was 12,000 calories in a little tin box that soldiers could basically carry into war. And if they were caught behind enemy lines, they could live off it, you know, until they got rescued. That was, you know, Ansel Keys' contribution. Well, after the war, he became interested in heart disease. He spent a sabbatical in England and saw their heart disease and saw that they were eating fish and chips and decided it must be the saturated fat. He then went to Pioppi, Italy, and where the, you know, the home of the Mediterranean diet, and decided, yes, it had to be the saturated fat, because they had not that much saturated fat. They had, you know, unsaturated fat. They had olive oil, but not very much saturated fat. And so he was convinced that saturated fat was the bad guy. He ended up publishing a volume back in the 1970s called the Seven Countries Study. And the Seven Countries Study looked at the countries. It was the U.S., Australia, Canada, U.K., and England and Wales, Italy, and Japan. And if you look at the percent mortality on one axis versus the consumption of saturated fat on the other axis, it was a relatively linear correlation. And he basically held this up to the world and said, see, it's the saturated fat. Well, he had an agenda. I mean, he was absolutely convinced that it was the saturated fat. Now, on the other side of this argument was a British physiologist, nutritionist, physician by the name of John Yudkin. And Yudkin, through his own work, had decided that sugar was the bad guy in the story. And he published a whole bunch of papers correlating sugar consumption with diabetes, gout, numerous other chronic diseases at the time, including heart disease. And so these guys duked it out during the course of the 60s and 70s. And there were some other people who got into the mix as well. The head of the Department of Nutrition at the Harvard School of Public Health, Fred Stair, who was a consultant to many, many companies, including all the breakfast cereal companies, by the way. And he was the one who basically told us that breakfast cereal was better than any other thing we could eat for breakfast, including bacon and eggs or anything else for that matter. Bottom line, these two duked it out over the years, and Keyes wasn't very nice, shall we say. He had a chip on his shoulder to be sure. He had a lot of hubris, and he actually said some nasty things in the literature about Yudkin. And Yudkin was a very demure British guy, proper, and he never fought back, and just thought the science should speak for itself. And basically, Keyes buried Yudkin. That's what happened. Now, the question is, why did Keyes bury Yudkin? So in the 1970s, we learned three things that buried Yudkin. And those three things were, number one, we learned about a molecule in our bloodstream called LDL. Okay, you still know what that one is today. Okay, low-density lipoprotein. Brown and Goldstein discovered this because they were studying patients who had a defect in the LDL receptor in their liver. This is a disease called familial hypercholesterolemia. It's a genetic disease. And if you have it, you basically have a heart attack by the time you're 18 years old. So this was a big deal. And these kids had sky-high LDL levels. So everyone assumed LDL was a bad guy in the story of heart disease. Okay. Then we learned that dietary fat raised your LDL, which is true. I mean, even today, if you eat dietary fat, your LDL will go up. I'm not arguing that. That is true. And then the third thing we learned was that in large population studies of hundreds of thousands of people in the 1970s, LDL levels correlated with risk for heart disease. So if dietary fat is A and LDL is B and heart disease is C, we learned that A led to B and B correlates with C, therefore A must lead to C. Dietary fat must lead to heart disease through LDL. Therefore, no A, no C. Get rid of the dietary fat, the LDL levels will come down and heart disease will go away. And Yudkin was thrown under the bus. Now, the question is, was that good science? And the answer to that is total, complete bullpucky, is what that is.
You can swear on the show if you would like.
Well, I probably shouldn't. Okay, bullpucky is as close as I can come. I'm from New York. I mean, it's really easy for me to swear, but I've been told I should not do that.
I'm from Massachusetts, right? So I have the same East Coast humor.
Okay. All right, bottom line is that didn't make sense at any level. It didn't make sense at a scientific level. It didn't even make sense at a logic level. But that's what happened. So yes, it is true that A leads to B, B correlates with C, but A could lead to D, E, F, G, H, and I and never come back to B or C, okay? And then the other problem is that the contrapositive of a logical argument is not no A, no C, it's no C, no A. So it doesn't even make sense on logistic grounds. So the bottom line is Keyes was wrong. Okay, but no one knew it, and we just all went low fat because Keyes told us. And if you look at what happened in 1977 with the very first dietary guidelines that from the McGovern Commission, we were basically told eat less fat. Now, in the fine print, it also said eat less salt and eat less sugar, but somehow that didn't make it. That only the eat less fat actually made it to the top. And to be honest with you, all of the industries, except for the cattlemen, cattle ranchers, Everybody else was really happy with this message of eat less fat. And you know why?
Less fat, more sugar, right? Because it's, I mean, that's
number one,
of the-
less fat, more sugar. And they learned that the more sugar they added, the more you bought. That's one reason. And the second reason was because when you take the fat out of the food, number one, you've created a new line of products. So they got to push a whole new line of products, you know, the low fat stuff. And number two, what are you going to do with the fat once you take it out? Like when you skim the fat off the milk, what happens to that fat? Does it end up in landfills? Does it end up in the ocean? Where does it end up? No, it ends up in cheese. Well, now the dairy industry had two products instead of one. They could sell both at, you know, top dollar. So that was a big boon for the, you know, for several food industries. And the CPG, you know, companies, you know, just ran with this and created new and, you know, greater low-fat products, you know, Entenmann's fat-free cakes and what have you, snack wells. You know, so if you look at the recipe on a snack well, you know, which is still with us, and I don't know why, but it's still there. Okay, it's 2 grams of fat down, 13 grams of carbohydrate up, 4 of which are sugar. Now, as it turns out, Yudkin got it right. But Yudkin's work was basically lost to the dustbin of history until the late 2000s. When we sort of resurrected it and, you know, started getting to real mechanism and actually, you know, looking at what the real story was. So, and, you know, I didn't go into it with an agenda. I wasn't looking for sugar per se, but, you know, I knew that something was causing this leptin resistance and we figured out it was insulin. So then we had to figure out what was causing the insulin resistance. And then we realized it was the liver fat. And then we had to ask, well, what was causing the liver fat? And then the answer became clear. It was sugar. So that's kind of how I got into it.
Yeah. The thing is, and I've been a gym rat most of my life. I go to the gym 4 or 5 times a week. I play sports. So diet nutrition has always been a part of my life. And I've always been intrigued with it. And I've been tricked throughout the years, you know, like trying to get my parents, you know, they bought the, I can't believe it's not butter stuff. They bought all the cheap stuff, and I'm Portuguese. I was born in Portugal. And I tell my mom, I'm like, listen, we've been tricked when we came to America. Like, go back and eat the way you ate back in the homeland, you know?
Indeed. I will never forget when I lived in Memphis, Tennessee, you know, working at St. Jude, a colleague of mine sent one of his medical students over to study with us for 2 months. And she was tall and thin and gorgeous, German medical student. And I remember her telling me when she got off the plane to come work with us that her boyfriend was very upset with her, not just because she was leaving for 2 months, but because she was going to America for 2 months. Because he said, everyone who goes to America gains 25 pounds. I like you the way you are. And indeed, she gained 25 pounds.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I mean, it is, and it's not just what we're eating. It's also the quality of our food. And I know that, you know, you've been kind of a person who's been linked to the fight against sugar and really exposing how addictive and how harmful it really is to our health. But I think, you know, like with your most recent book, which I have right here, you also focus a lot on processed foods, and something that you talk about a lot and talking to people, I mean, being somebody who's into health and nutrition, as you know, like you talked about dogma in the beginning of the show, you want to talk about dogmas. I mean, people really, you know, they fall in love with whatever diet they're doing, and it becomes the end all be all. And I mean, you basically join a cult. It's like, I'm a keto guy. I've been doing keto for a long time. I've had Dr. Dominic D'Agostino on. I've had Dr. Thomas Seyfried. I've had Jim Abrams, who one of the filmmakers of one of my favorite movies ever, Naked Gun, on. And I love the health benefits of it. But like you discuss all the time, it's about processed foods. And if you can find a diet that works for you, where you feel good and you know, and it works for you, then do it. Who am I to say that whatever works for me is the best option for you? And the other thing too, like you've said before, some of the common things that all these diets have, and I've told people this in the past, like you ever see that, like they all kind of tell you, like, remove as many grains as you can, remove processed foods as much as you can. So some of the common things, like, people act like they're cults and we have to fight, but it's like there's actually some things we agree on, and the core foundation of why these diets work, I think, are probably some of those similarities.
Well, in fact, you know, I say very specifically, you know, there's this fight right now between the vegans and the ketos, you know, and I think that the vegans and ketos are actually on the same side. They just don't know it, but they are actually on the same side. You know, first of all, you can do veganism right, or you can do veganism wrong. Don't forget that Coke, Doritos, and Oreos are vegan. Okay. Number two, you can do keto right, or you can do keto wrong. So if you do keto right, you have to stay in nutritional ketosis, all right? And that's not easy to do. You have to monitor yourself to know that you're still expelling ketones either through your breath or your urine. And you have to monitor yourself. The minute you divert, the minute you have an indulgence, you know, you have just spiked your insulin. Your insulin has now shut down your ketogenesis. And now, instead of being on a ketogenic diet, you are on a high fat, medium carbohydrate diet, which is the single worst diet that there is. So, yes, a ketogenic diet makes a lot of sense for a lot of people, not for everyone, but for a lot of people. For instance, if you have familial hypercholesterolemia, you do not need a ketogenic diet. That would be a bad idea. That's 1 in 500. But if you have insulin resistance, if you're pre-diabetic, you know, a ketogenic diet might make very good sense. The goal is to improve insulin sensitivity by getting rid of the liver fat. And the ketones themselves are signaling molecules that tell the mitochondria to work harder, better, faster, and make more of them, which is a good thing. You know, the goal is to basically improve your mitochondrial function. That is, you know, job one of pretty much any diet. And ketones will do that. So if you're on a ketogenic diet and you stay on it, that's actually a good thing. The problem is most people are not doing that. They are saying, oh, here's the keto ice cream in the, you know, freezer section of my local supermarket. Oh, it says 6 grams of carbohydrate. Oh, that's good, because the regular amount of carbohydrate in an ice cream is about, you know, 35. Oh, so this is much better. You know, as soon as you eat those 6 grams of carbohydrate, your insulin shoots up, your ketones stop, and, you know, you've fallen out. So, you know, You have to be extraordinarily fastidious. Ultimately, everything that's on a ketogenic diet is real food. Everything that's on a vegan diet that works is real food. It's when you eat either ketogenic or vegan processed food that you're not on any diet. And that's where the problem is.
Yeah, I think the thing about these trends is sometimes good things come out of it. Like you said, now you can find some decent ketogenic products out there but in a way it's almost a bad thing too, because before you had all these ketogenic products, you made everything from scratch, and that's the best way of making it.
It's the only way you know what's in it.
Exactly. And you buy the ingredients, you put it together, and you know, you've said it before, it's like there shouldn't be any nutritional facts or any label on it, I should say. And if there's no label on it, it's probably something you should be eating.
That's well. So basically what I say is every nutrition facts label is a warning label. It means something's been done to the food, because if it was real food, you wouldn't need a label. And basically two things have been done to the food. The whole book really is about food processing, you know, metabolical, the lure and the lies of processed food, nutrition, and modern medicine. Basically what I say in this book is that in order for any given food to be healthy, it has to adhere to two precepts, six words, two precepts, easy. You can write them down. You can memorize them. One, protect the liver. Two, feed the gut. Any food that does both is healthy. Any food that does neither is poison. And any food that does one or the other, but not both, is somewhere in the middle. And the empiric data on any given food or food category actually supports that. So the question is, protect the liver. Well, protect it from what? Protect it from the onslaught of glucose and fructose in terms of refined carbohydrate, which should not get absorbed in the duodenum, but when it's refined carbohydrate does, gets absorbed too early and floods the liver, creating all of this liver fat because the liver can't handle the load, turns it into liver fat. And when that liver fat precipitates in the liver, now you have fatty liver disease. Now the pancreas has to make more insulin to make the liver do its job. Now you've got high insulin levels all over the body, driving number one, weight gain, and number two, driving cell division, because insulin's job is a mitogen. It causes cell division. And if it's causing cell division in your coronary arteries, now you have hardening of the arteries. And if it's causing cell division in your breast tissue, now you got breast cancer. So protect it from simple carbohydrate, protect it from branched chain amino acids, leucine, isoleucine, valine, which you need for muscle, but if you overdo, then your liver has to turn those branched chain amino acids into organic acids. They have to deamidate them. And so now you've created too much substrate for your mitochondria to handle. Guess what? They get turned into liver fat too. And so you end up with the same problem. Protect it from glyphosate, protect it from heavy metals. So there's a whole bunch of things to protect the liver from. Protect it from iron. Feed the gut. So people don't understand that your microbiome is super important. You know, people are talking about the gut microbiome all the time now, but they don't really understand what it's about. Okay, so you have 10 trillion cells in your body, but you have 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. They outnumber you 10 to 1. They got to eat something. Well, what do they eat? Well, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did they get? If you absorb everything in your early intestine, in your duodenum, it goes straight to your liver, you are starving your intestinal bacteria. And your intestinal bacteria do not like to be starved. So if you don't feed your gut will feed on you. It will actually strip the mucin layer right off your intestinal epithelial cells, chew it up for its own purposes to keep alive. Now you have basically denuded your best barrier against all your intestinal contents, all the SHIT that's in your intestine, which smells really bad because it's got really bad stuff in it. Okay. That stuff is outside your body. Okay. And the barrier of your intestine is keeping it from entering your body. But you have now just stripped away the single best barrier that you have. And so what you would do is you expose the bloodstream to all of the bad stuff that's trapped in your intestine looking for a way out, all right? So lipopolysaccharides, cytokines, full bacteria themselves, they exit the intestine through these holes that have been made in the intestine, which normally are blocked up by something called tight junctions, but now those tight junctions are dysfunctional because you've denuded the entire intestine. They enter the bloodstream. This is a process called leaky gut. And now you set up a systemic inflammation throughout the entire body. You feel like crap. Your mitochondria go to hell. You end up, flooding your liver. You get liver insulin resistance, and sometimes it will even get past your liver all the way to your brain. And the same tight junctions that occur in your gut also occur in your brain. You can damage them there too, and so you can end up with depression. You can end up with behavioral health disorders. You can end up with psychiatric disease, all from your GI tract because you didn't feed your gut. So what does your gut eat? It eats fiber. The problem is the fiber has been removed by the food industry because fast food is fiberless food because you can't freeze fiber. So addition of sugar for palatability, i.e. sales, and removal of fiber for shelf life, i.e. depreciation. Sales and depreciation. The food industry processes our food, not for us. They process our food for them. and we get sick.
Yeah, that's where that saying, I have a gut feeling, comes from. You know, it's this brain gut connection that I think many people weren't even aware of. And it, like you said, it affects your mood. I mean, there's so much of an impact on your emotions, your brain, like all these things that you think have nothing to do with your gut can be affected by gut issues.
That's right. So bottom line is, if you ate real food, you wouldn't have these issues. Now, within real food, there are some people who will do better on a high-fat, low-carb diet. There'll be some people who will do better on a low-fat, high-carb diet. There are ways to figure it out. I actually, you know, spend chapter 9 in the book explaining how to diagnose your own biochemical profile. But there's one kind of food that never works: processed food.
Yeah, and the thing is too, I've seen studies or at least theories on, and I'd love to get your opinion on this if you think there's anything there, but the idea of that, the reason why we can't fit all our teeth in our mouths and all this stuff is because of the way we eat. It's affected our hormones, or our faces are smaller and skinnier.
I just wrote a chapter on this with my colleague, Dr. Kevin Boyd, who is a paleodontist, on exactly that. On the fact that our food has affected our face. So number one, breastfeeding. So it turns out the amount of negative pressure that your tongue has to make against your hard palate in order to suckle on a breast is enormous. And what it does is it puts tremendous pressure on the hard palate. And there's a suture called the incisive suture that has to grow in order to make way to increase the airway so that you can actually oxygenate enough as you get older. And if you don't do that, what ends up happening is your palate ends up forming an arched palate, a high arched palate. You end up closing down on your airway, and you end up with sleep disordered breathing, obstructive sleep apnea, and metabolic disease as an adult. So that's one reason, is the switch to bottle feeding from breastfeeding, because bottle feeding, they don't need to generate that negative pressure. And then the second thing is baby food. So once upon a time, before there was baby food, the very first baby food in the entire world was in 1901. And then in 1927 was Beechnut. Okay. But you know, before 1901, okay, there were thousands and thousands of years of mothers feeding babies, okay? Otherwise, we would have basically gone the way of the dodo bird. Somehow, mothers had to feed their babies without baby food. How'd they do it? The answer is they would stick the food, the adult food, in their mouths. They would macerate it themselves with their own teeth, and then they would drop it in the baby's mouth, and the baby would gum it to death. That's how babies fed before there was processed baby food.
This sounds time-consuming. Huh? That sounds time-consuming, gumming it to death. But if you're a baby,
birds still do it that way. Okay,
yeah.
That's how birds do it. All right, that we did it that way too until baby food. Well, it turns out that process of gumming it to death grew the four muscles of mastication, the masseter, the temporalis, and the medial and lateral pterygoids, in order to be able to grow that airway. And so that is another, you know, problem that has developed. That's another, you know, innocent bystander that's gone by the wayside because of our processed food. So, you know, basically formula and baby food has put babies at risk, not necessarily when they're babies, but when they're older children, when they're adults. And we have a malocclusion problem. Like you said, we don't have enough room for the teeth in our mouth. And the reason is because we didn't grow the maxilla or the mandible, you know, the two jaw bones. For exactly the same reason. And that's what's in this chapter that that Dr. Boyd and I just wrote. So processed food affects us at every single level, you know, throughout our entire lives. And it's always working against us. It's never working for us. The only way it works for us is in cost, coolness, and, you know, and cheap, you know, and, you know, being cheap. So the question is that good enough? And the answer is no, it's not good enough. Because the food industry grosses $1.5 trillion a year, of which $650 billion is gross profit. So that's a gross profit margin of 45%. Next highest, by the way, is Big Pharma at 21%. So 45%, 21%. You tell me, you know, this is, there's a lot of money riding on this. All right. But medical costs in America are now up to $3.8 trillion, of which 75% is chronic disease, of which 75% could be prevented if we could go back to levels from 50 years ago, 1970, before processed food basically took over. So if you do the math, 75% of 75% of $3.8 trillion is $2 trillion. So we lose triple what the food industry makes, cleaning up their mess. That's unsustainable.
Yeah, and the crazy part, we try to fix the problem by saying, how do we get people more affordable medicine? You know, and it's like, wait. Well, how about we get to the root cause of the issue, which is something you talk about all the time. It's like, stop trying to fix the or try to put patch up the symptom. Let's get to the root cause and maybe look at our food. But it's hilarious that doctors will admit that, like, hey, if you eat healthy, then it can improve your health. But yet when you're unhealthy, they don't ever recommend like changing your diet to fix the problem or to try to see if the diet, if it is a dietary problem.
Well, people, first of all, people don't understand nutrition. Okay. Nutritionists don't understand nutrition because they're still on calories. You know, as far as my job is to kill the calorie. The calorie was never a useful measure of health.
And you still help people, people say, oh, all you got to do is less calories in, more calories out. And it's like, it's not that simple.
It doesn't work. When has it ever worked? Well, it can't work because of the leptin resistance, because of the insulin resistance. The only way to make that happen is by getting the insulin down. Well, you can't get the insulin down with processed food.
So, but there are people who, even friends of mine, that I disagree with this calorie in, calorie out thing, where they're like, oh, I just eat less and I lose weight because I'm burning more. And it's just like, kind of, but how long will that work for? And are there going to be some long-term prices to pay because of the lack of nutritionally dense food?
Absolutely. And, you know, just remember what they say about caloric restriction. You won't live longer. It'll just feel like it.
That's funny. One thing I love about your perspective on so much of this is that you always go into the history of how we got here. And I think history is so important because
you can't fix it. If you drive into a ditch, you got to know how you drove in because you got to back your way out. You can't drive through a ditch. You know, all you do is just spin your wheels and end up deeper. And that's what we've been doing.
And you're one of the few people that I hear talk about the Flexner Report, the Rockefellers, and their influence in modern medicine.
So, you know, the Flexner Report was held as a watershed moment in the history of medicine, because basically what it said was, you got to get rid of all the mythology. Evidence-based science only. And that sounds really good, except, of course, that's not really what happened. But that was, you know, that was the call. And that's what got rid of, you know, like phrenology, you know, like the bumps on your head. And that's what got rid of, you know, biothermy and a whole bunch of, you know, other things that, you know, sort of didn't make sense. And yeah, that was good. But it also got rid of nutrition. So the very first vitamin was isolated in 1912. The Flexner Report came out in 1910. And the Flexner Report said that food was a non-issue in terms of health. Well, we already knew in 1912 that that was wrong. And of course, we've only learned since all the other things. But we've never learned nutrition in medical school. You know, only 28% of medical schools even have a nutrition curriculum, because the Flexner Report said that it was basically gobbledygook, that it was, you know, alchemy, that it was voodoo. And so doctors don't learn nutrition. So that left a big opening for the dietitians. The dietitians, turns out, they have their own mythology. And, you know, I explain in the book where that comes from. So the dietitians are organized. They have an organization called the AND, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. They used to be, before they rebranded, they used to be called the ADA, the American Dietetic Association. Some of you will remember that organization. That was founded in 1917. And who was the founder of this organization? A woman by the name of Lena Cooper. Lena Cooper was not a dietitian. Lena Cooper never took a dietetics course or got a dietetics degree or certification in her life. Lena Cooper was the apprentice to none other than Dr. John Harvey Kellogg of Battle Creek, Michigan, who ran a spa for the well-heeled, well-to-do, based on two precepts. He saw the problems of the late 19th and early 20th century as twofold: constipation and masturbation.
Yeah.
He was going to put an end to both of those.
I think masturbation won. I'm just kidding.
I'm not going there, but okay. Constipation and masturbation. He felt that meat was the cause of all evil. And the reason he felt that way was because he was a Seventh-day Adventist. And the head of the Seventh-day Adventist, the primary person of the Seventh-day Adventist, was an Ellen G. White, who basically told her that God came to her in a vision and told her that eating flesh meat was the ultimate sin. And the entire Seventh-day Adventist sect grew up around, you know, being completely vegetarian, vegan. And John Harvey Kellogg believed this with all his heart. He actually, at age 12, edited the works of Ellen G. White before he went to medical school. So, you know, they learned about proteins in medical school. Apparently, you know, he must have, you know, slept through that class, because he was not interested in that. What he was interested in was carbohydrate, because carbohydrate was the antidote to meat. And of course, that's where, you know, Kellogg's breakfast cereal came from. The bottom line is that the American Dietetic Association adopted these precepts and practices throughout their entire history. And they basically adopted the precept of calories. And that came out in 1916 from a gentleman who was trying to do his best. His name was Wilbur Atwater. And the Atwater equation, developed in 1916, showed that fat had the most calories at 9 calories per gram. Protein had the next most at 4.2. And then carbohydrate had the next most at 4.1. And so if you're trying to limit your calories, the best thing to do was get rid of fat, which meant get rid of meat. And so there went the American Dietetic Association. And so to this, to this day, we have not been able to get dietitians to accept the notion that calories are, you know, the whole concept of calories are flawed.
The other interesting thing about Kellogg was he was very proud he was anti-premarital sex, right? Wasn't one of the influences of his very boring cereal was because he didn't want to spice anybody up? And
exactly right. Yes, he was a true, honest-to-goodness Seventh-day Adventist, and he lived by all 28 precepts.
That's wild. I mean, it really is wild. And so this is really a huge influence on how we looked at looking at foods and homeopathic medicines and natural remedies as something that was kind of accepted in the world, to now almost looked at as pseudoscience.
Well, indeed, you know, the bottom line is that's why we have science, is to, you know, debunk the pseudoscience or the dogma or the religion, you know, of the previous generation. You know, the problem is that there are hangers-on. There are people who want it to be that way. So I tell the story in the book of a paper that's very important, and everyone should take a look at it and read it. In 1911, Max Planck, the famous German physicist of Planck's constant, famously threw an offhand comment out to the audience. And he basically said, science advances one funeral at a time. And what he meant by that was that the gurus of any given field in science have a stranglehold on the field until they're dead. And it's not until that the guru dies that the field can move forward, because they basically squelch any dissent, any challenges, you know, to their authority or to their philosophy. So the question was, you know, was Planck right? You know, could you prove that science advances one funeral at a time? And a set of scientists from MIT, working with the National Bureau of Economic Research, first authors Azoulay, came out in 2015, put this question to the test. And what they did was they took the entire roster of the National Academy of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences, and they made a database for each of the gurus, and they looked up every single paper that the gurus wrote in their career, and every one of those papers might have a co-author. So they made a database for each co-author as well. And they did this for 20 years, a 20-year time span. Then they said, okay, in that 20 years, some of these gurus will have died. So let's mark in the timeline where the gurus died. And then the question is, what happened to the co-authors after the guru died? And it turned out the co-authors are publishing. And as soon as the guru died, fell off a cliff. Never heard from again. So indeed, science advances one funeral at a time. So then they asked the question, all right, if the co-authors are not publishing in that field, who is? So they use MeSH terms, you know, medical subject heading terms that are listed, you know, in papers now, to figure out who was publishing. It turned out it was a completely new set of people with a completely new set of ideas, philosophies, and science. And obviously, those people had been squelched up to that point. And it was only after the guru died that they were able to start getting their stuff into print. So indeed, science advances one funeral at a time. So bottom line, it is our job, it is scientists' job to overturn dogma. The problem is the politics get in the way.
That's why I hate the term the science is settled, because science is never settled. It's the most unscientific thing you could say.
Well, the fact is, it is true that it is never settled. That's true. On the other hand, sometimes you actually have to start basing policy based on science, because if you always say the science isn't settled, then you'll never do anything. So that's called the pessimistic meta-induction theory. Well, yeah, well, what we believed 10 years ago is already wrong, and what we believe today will be wrong 10 years from now. So why do anything? Why don't we just hold everything constant and never do anything, because God knows we'll be wrong? Well, then you'll never advance either. So while you're right, Ricky, the science is never settled. At some point, you know, you just got to basically put your foot down and say, you know, we got to do something. And we're at that point in nutrition.
How much did it concern you throughout 2020 when no conversations were publicly being shared about, hey, how do we improve the strength of our immune system? Maybe, you know, we should be concerned about vitamin D deficient people. Maybe we should be worried about all these other things. Like, it was the only remedies that were ever publicly talked about were obviously vaccines. And, you know, there was a little bit of conversation about, you know, pharmaceuticals, hydroxychloroquine and some of the other ones.
Yeah. Which, you saw how well that worked out.
Well, that, yeah. Well, but I think those were demonized also because of the fact that they wanted to make sure that, I mean, if people were having success, I mean, you hear stories of doctors all over the world having success with with zinc and all these other alternatives, but everything was demonized. Everything. I mean, if we're on YouTube a year from ago talking about vitamin C, we would have been shut down immediately. It was amazing how dangerous it was to even discuss the idea of increasing your immune system and actually taking your health into your own hands.
All right, so I'm going to push back on you a little bit here, okay? I'm about the science. I'm a scientist, okay? And an N of one is not science, all right? A clinical trial does not mean a string of patients that you handed hydroxychloroquine to and see what happens. That's not science. So, you know, ultimately, you have to do the science right. You can do a string of patients. You can do a case series. And what that is called is discovery. That is not science. Discovery is not science. Epidemiology is not science, right? You need proof, right? And proof comes in two flavors. You can either do randomized controlled trials, or you can do what's known as econometric analysis. That's the level of proof we have, say, for tobacco and lung cancer, all right? No one's ever, you know, taken a cohort of patients and started them smoking and shown that they, you know, get lung cancer. That would be unethical, illegal, and you'd end up in jail. So we have to be able to have natural history studies that have the appropriate levels of controls to be able to make those determinations. Same as football trauma and chronic traumatic encephalopathy, same as asbestos and mesothelioma, same as climate change, okay? There are no control groups for that. There's no randomized control trial for any of that, but we still know those if things are true. That's called econometric analysis. So those are the two levels that you have to be able to broach, either econometric or RCTs. That's science. Now, we didn't have that for any of these other things. We didn't have it for hydroxychloroquine, we didn't have it for vitamin D. I've seen all the data for vitamin D. I have a good friend who studies vitamin D, and he has made a very, very good argument that vitamin D is extraordinarily important because it induces toll-like receptors, which is extremely important in modulating the immune system and preventing an out-of-control cytokine response. And I believe in vitamin D. I do. Okay, we still don't have a randomized controlled trial for it, and we still don't have an econometric analysis for it. So you have to be very, very, shall we say, hard ass about this.
But isn't what was concerning?
N of one is not science.
Well, I agree with everything you said. My only issue with the whole thing was there also isn't any science, any real science, because obviously we're in a state of emergency, so we can kind of fast track the whole scientific process and the whole FDA approval process behind what we are pushing on the people, the whole vaccine. So my thing is like, believe me, I'm the most anti-pharms. I always say, look for natural, take care of your health first, eat well, exercise, and then use pharmaceuticals as a last resort. So I'm not pro pharmaceuticals. I just could see how all these other things were being demonized. I mean, hydroxychloroquine is a generic drug that's been around for a long time. It's a decision that should be, between the patient and the doctor. And in New York, where you live, Cuomo decided to make that decision for us. And to me,
I actually live in San Francisco.
Oh,
but,
sorry.
So I'm gonna argue back at you.
Yeah.
All right. The fact of the matter is, there is this thing called public health, and public health matters. All right. And sometimes you have to do societal things to influence the public health.
No, I agree with that.
There are even legal precepts to that. 1905, Jacobson v. Massachusetts. A Cambridge pastor from Sweden by the name of Jacobson refused to take a smallpox vaccine, went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, get vaccinated or get deported. So in fact, there is a legal precept for being part of a public health effort. We have to live within a society, and we have to be careful about our externalities, about what our efforts do to others. So I believe wholeheartedly that vaccines, mm-hmm, while being highly questionable, are absolutely essential at this point in time. And if you take a look at the history of vaccines over the years, polio, diphtheria, pertussis, you know, people don't remember any of those diseases. You know what? I do. I've taken care of all of them. I've taken care of polio. I've taken care of diphtheria. I've taken care of pertussis. I've taken care of measles, mumps, rubella. I've taken care of all H flu, meningitis, H flu, epiglottitis. You name a disease that's treatable with a vaccine today, and I've taken care of it. And I'm going to tell you, we are way better off without those diseases in our lives. Well, and so we're going to be a lot better off without COVID in our lives too.
Yeah, no, I agree. We're better without COVID in our lives. They're not traditional vaccines. Some of them are gene therapy.
That's not gene therapy. mRNA is not gene therapy. That is not true.
It's not a traditional vaccine.
And it is a traditional vaccine. It just doesn't use the protein as the template. It uses the messenger RNA as the template. That doesn't make it gene therapy. I disagree with you.
Which one of the pharmaceutical companies, one of them has, this is the first vaccine that they've created, right?
Moderna,
right? And what was their past research? Wasn't it in gene therapy?
No. It's always been in delivering mRNA as a template for developing proteins. You know, they were able to adapt it for, you know, making this vaccine. And, you know, all I can say is I hear you about the concern. I hear you about side effects. If you look at the side effect profile of even the worst of the vaccines, which is the J&J vaccine, in terms of these blood clots that came up, the frequency of this is so infinitesimal compared to the death rate from people who get this disease that, you know, from a statistical standpoint, you can't even make the argument.
Yeah, well, let me push back a little bit. There's been a lot of evidence that the numbers have been skewed. I mean, initially, I had Dr. Scott Jensen on. He's a family physician, but also a senator. He's one of many people who've gone back and audited deaths that were considered COVID deaths. And you see car accidents, you see all these things. I mean, Dr. Birx, during a press conference, said we're counting people who die with and by the coronavirus as COVID deaths. I mean, they publicly said it, and you see cases of that. I know close friends of mine, I know family members, people who have had loved ones who passed away. It might have been a contributing factor. It wasn't necessarily the cause of death. And
you know, I'm going to be very honest with you. Okay, I am not an immunologist. I am not a virologist. Yeah. All I can tell you is you can look at the case study rate before the vaccines were introduced and after the vaccines were introduced, and your argument doesn't hold water.
Yeah, but okay. So why aren't we telling people that? I mean, we're pushing. We know that the seasonal flu is more dangerous to children than this is, and yet they're pushing this onto the public, to children. We're pushing it on pregnant women. We have no studies to know what long-term effects on a virus that, if you look at statistically, it's really old people and obese people, vitamin D deficient people. I mean, you can kind of narrow down the people who are really at threat. And yet,
so are you familiar with this MISC, multisystem inflammatory disease of children?
I've heard of that.
It's pretty darn common, and we're seeing it more and more because more and more kids are getting infected. This is not a good disease. This disease causes a vasculitis, and that vasculitis seems to last a very long time, if not permanently. This is not a good thing to have. We want to stop this as soon as we can.
No, I agree with that 100%. I mean,
how are you going to do that without the vaccine?
Well, the vaccine doesn't stop the spread. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies will tell you that themselves, and it doesn't stop you from getting it. It only stops you from possibly not dying of severe symptoms. So
that's pretty good too.
That's pretty good, but they're not selling you that. They're showing you commercials of, and you know just as well as I do, pharmaceutical. When you watch the news, every other, and we're one of two countries in the world that let pharmaceutical companies actually market on TV. and you know, to quote Bill Maher, I think years ago, he said that once you're going to your doctor for the drugs instead of them giving them to you, then they become your drug dealer. And that's kind of what's happened. And we know
that. Well, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, is to basically stop that, is very specifically because those drugs are not treating the disease, they're treating the symptoms of disease. It's like giving an aspirin to a patient with a brain tumor because they have a headache. Okay, you may fix the headache, and that's all well and good, but it's not doing a damn thing for the brain tumor. Same thing for all of the antihypertensives, all the hypoglycemic agents, and for the LDL lowering drugs. Yeah, it fixes the symptom. It doesn't fix the cause. The whole point is to get to the root cause. And it turns out the root cause is our crappy food.
Yeah, which regardless where we stand on the other stuff, I mean, one thing we can all agree on is that your best defense against disease in many cases, it's your own immune system. And it's, you know,
I won't argue that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one. I didn't mean to end it on a disagreement, but I like to be honest and have open discussions. And if I disagree with somebody or somebody disagrees with me, I hope that they push back, because that's how we learn. You know, you don't learn from only talking to people you agree with. You know, so
you just do it respectfully.
Yeah, absolutely. So, where's the best place to find your book?
Oh, I don't care where they get it. They can get it wherever they want. Amazon, Barnes & Noble. To be honest with you, the place you should get it is your local bookstore. Bookstores are happiness, and we need to have more bookstores in our lives. So I think you should frequent your local bookstore as much as is humanly possible.
Yeah, well, the placebo effect's a real thing, and so is the nocebo effect. The idea of, I think, all the anxiety and tension can actually ruin your health, obviously. The opposite's true too. I mean, being in a good mood and thinking positive thoughts can also help your health. So that's but thank you so much. I'll put links to your book and your website and all that stuff in the show description so people can find your work. I mean, I'm sure people are familiar with, I mean, you've been in Sugar Coated, you've been in so many different documentaries and been a part of so many conferences in this fight against processed food and modern medicine. So I really appreciate all the years of work and research, and hopefully we talk again in the near future.
Thanks very much for having me, Rick.
Hey, thanks. Have a great night.
My pleasure. I believe in the ripple effect.